You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today we're hearing from Todd Barry. Absolutely wonderful. Dry, whispering, slow-paced. What other things can we say about Todd that aren't beaten to death by people trying to describe his stuff? Todd is a very low-energy, high-precision performer, and we're going to be talking a lot about his most recent tour, his crowd work tour, where he goes on stage with no prepared material and just plays with the crowd, but in a way in which you are unlikely, very unlikely, I would say, to have seen it done before. This, without further ado, is the brilliant Todd Barry. How was last night? You're doing crowd work at the Soho Theatre.
I'm doing the crowd work tour, yeah. It's gone three, like, I think each night it's gotten better.
Okay.
I've done three, and the first night was good, then the second night was, I would say, really good, and last night was really good also. So maybe all three good.
Okay.
But, yeah, because I didn't know what to expect if they were going to...
This is the first time you've done crowd work in the UK?
It's the first time I've done a crowd work show, yeah, in the UK.
Sure. Just for those that that haven't yet caught up with it, the crowd work tour is no prepared material.
Right. It's just kind of what's going on. I start pretty mundane conversations, and hopefully they lead somewhere that's not mundane.
Okay.
Or they're mundane and they're funny.
So are you... How much of your act beforehand was crowd work before you embarked on this tour?
Well, I always tend to do it like... I just hit this moment in my show or where I'm just bored, and then you just kind of sometimes, or I'll have a joke prepared and I'll bounce it off someone, you know, I'll have a joke about being a picky eater and I'll ask someone any picky eaters here, and then someone will, I'll have a funny, hopefully funny discussion, and then I'll ease into my joke.
Yeah.
So I've always done, for that, I can't remember when I started to do it, but at some point and then I've had shows where like I probably did too much crowd work, but at some point I wanted to do something to shake things up for me, so I said, why don't I book a whole tour where I just do crowd work?
Because you were known as kind of almost a one, not quite a one-liner comic, but
no,
certainly...
No, I wouldn't say a one-liner, but I'm not necessarily a ranter, but...
Sure.
So, I mean, I think I was known as... I'm not dead. I've been known as a, somewhat decent joke writer.
Yeah. And I noticed the track listing on Medium Energy is it's literally one track per joke. Some of them are 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, you know,
long.
That kind of blew up in my face because I released that iTunes, I think. And, you know, in 2000 when I introduced that myself. And so I just name every time I change a subject, I would name the track. And then it was on some subscription services like eMusic, which I don't know if they have that here, but just download sites. And they would charge 99 cents per track. And people were like, I'm not going to spend $60, $58 to buy your album. I'm like, okay. So then.
I mean, they're good jokes.
Yeah,
you would think
but,
a joke was worth 99 cents.
But, you know, like a 20-second joke for 99 cents. But, yeah, so then I ended up grouping them. So it's,
okay.
But, yeah, I did. You change with the times.
I think what I'm driving at is that you were not known for crowd work. It's quite unusual that it be you that says, I'm going to do a tour that's just crowd work.
I think people who knew me, you know, had seen me a lot or a number of times would sort of knew I was good at it or could be good at it. But I think there are a bunch of people who were surprised, like, wow, I never would have expected him to do this, which is good. because I think it turned out that the film turned out all right. Yeah, so I mean, someone wrote that. Oh, I saw someone comment like, "Oh, he's kind of low energy. I didn't know he'd be good at crowd work." Like, I don't. It's just a conversation. You don't need to be high energy to have a conversation with someone.
Yeah, it certainly is the way you do it. Because I have to say, knowing your act a little bit before hearing about the crowd work special, which I've now seen and people can watch on Netflix and or buy from your site.
Yeah.
Which I noticed that on your Twitter handle earlier. I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Put it on Netflix and sell it for people who don't have Netflix.
Well, it was originally... I know we're going off on a tangent here.
That's
but
fine. We can do
it
that.
Was originally... I mean, the way it happened was I booked a crowd work tour by myself. Then I wanted to... And people said, oh, did you film it? I was like, I don't want to start following a camera crew, following a range. Just it's a lot of preparation to do something like that. And it's just, I'd rather just go do the shows. And then I booked a second tour, and I was like, maybe I should just put the effort into recording this somehow. So I was all ready to write. I was sort of writing to Netflix. I knew someone over there who I'd met. And I was like, kind of going to put it out there. And then Louis C.K. called me up. You know, he's an old friend of mine. And we just were talking, shooting the shit, and he's like, what have you been up to? I go, well, I'm trying to get, I'm doing this tour. I do all crowd work, and, I'm thinking of writing to Netflix, see if they would put it out. And he's like, and he started asking me questions, and he's just like, right there on the spot, he goes, would you let me put this out and on my site? And I was like, yeah. So, I mean, it was...
Would you rather deal with the vagaries of a big business or have me, a trusted old friend with a huge connection to an audience?
Would you rather seal this deal right now or hope that that guy is not on vacation when you send him an email?
And, sure.
And, I mean, it much more of a long shot that Netflix would have just suddenly done all that, hired a production crew. But Louis was like, yeah, let's do it. And there was a director who I knew, and he happened to be free that week and a half. And it all, then all of a sudden, like, I just showed up in these towns and those cameras set up. And so it was pretty nice.
I think when I first heard about the idea of a crowd work tour, before I kind of connected it with the fact it was you doing crowd work, that feels like, I suppose you could kind of see that as a kind of a lazy idea. Like, I'm just going to wing it. There's plenty of comics who are, maybe ranty or maybe not ranty, maybe more conversational, high energy comics. I think we can imagine the idea of like, oh, a crowd work tour, there's going to be a lot of, hey, buddy, where you're from. Mm-hmm. But the way in which you have the conversations it's such a measured, your pace is so measured and your authority on stage is so measured that I just wonder whether you are kind of uniquely placed. You can afford yourself a huge amount of time to have a conversation with someone. And some of the angles that you're throwing in, like in the Netflix movie, that band, and I'm not going to remember the name,
Avant Abstract.
Yeah, of course I looked at their MySpace page afterwards. But the fact that you were then like, did you manage to get avantabstract.com? That's a great line of questioning, so I wondered whether you had prepared lines of questioning to go.
No, I didn't. I mean, sometimes you end up doing a few shows in a row where you have a musician in the crowd and you maybe go down, like, sometimes we'll just go, tell me some song titles.
Okay.
So, but not like, there's nothing like at 28 minutes into the show, I'm going to ask this guy this. Because I don't know who I didn't know they were going to be in the audience.
Yeah, of course.
So, for the most part, it's pretty much what it promises to be, which is spontaneous.
And conversely, are you careful not to tread down more well-worn paths in crowd work?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go for just something cheap. I mean, and I try to go for, just go for angles that might not be expected. Or, like, there was that scene with an actor in Vancouver segment of the crowd work tour film. And where I just ended up going, let's run your lines for your audition. That was really fun. And just, like, didn't know that was about to happen, so...
And do you think you could stand by an hour of a release of one gig? Could you go, oh, this is the whole thing?
Because it was seven,
Five different shows or seven shows, you kind of get to pick the best bit.
Yeah, I think depending on the show, like I think the last few nights I could have just picked one of those and, I would have squeezed some of the air out of it in editing, but yeah, I think I could. It depends on the show, but I mean, having Seven Cities gave it a different feel. Yeah. He gave me on the road kind of feel, and
yeah, you really got a sense of, I'm going to embarrass myself now by not remembering the name, but the one where was in San Francisco where everyone was, there was a guy who kind of, I can't even remember the details now, but there was a, you know, there was like a particularly hippie city where everyone was oh, what I do is I, you know, manufacture bubbles or whatever. I can't remember what he said.
Yeah, that could have been San Francisco or Portland, probably.
I think it was Portland. I'm definitely thinking
of
Portland.
Or Seattle or really any place that I would visit.
So you, just to briefly follow that line of questioning, you would tour those particular towns. I guess would you describe yourself as an alt comic?
No, I get called that, and I think I get called that because the rooms that were sort of named alt rooms or deigned, if that's the right word, alt rooms, I would perform at those. So I was definitely part of, like, when I found out there was a scene of people who were like, and I, part of it was started like by my manager who started this Luna Lounge show.
Okay.
Way back in New York. And it was an alternative space, but I never would do it in a way that was like, hey, they had to come up with a new category of comedy for me because what I'm doing is so different. And it's like, because I'm fine just being called a comedian. And if someone writes a blog or something and calls me an alt comic, I will sometimes write to them, go, can you just call
really?
Me a comic? Yeah, I have done that before.
Why is that specifically?
Because I think it's sort of a empty, pretentious, because I mean, a lot of these rooms that are alt rooms, people are just doing stand-up. There's nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing. You know, sometimes someone will go up there and do something really conceptual or a character thing that might not fly in a stand-up club. But so that, in that sense, I sort of see it. But a lot of it is just straight stand-up about, you know, I could go do it in the most mainstream comedy club in the world and also at the alt room.
So is there a sort of a degree to which you're managing your brand by saying you don't want to be called an alt? I feel awful that I've even said that sentence.
No one wants to say they have a brand, but I mean, some people do. I would be someone who wouldn't say that, but I know what you're saying at the same time. I never thought of it that way. I really just don't want to be lumped into some sort of empty. I mean, when I use the term alternative comedy, I usually will use it as a shorthand for a room that might be at a bar or not in a full-time comedy club, but not necessarily like, I'm better than those club comics, you know, because I'm
sure.
Because there's people who don't do the alt rooms who are, you know, among the funniest people in the world. Like someone like Dave Attell is powerhouse. He's one of the funniest. You're familiar with Dave?
Yeah,
he's fantastic, and he doesn't really go near those rooms.
Sure. So you've been doing comedy for a good while.
Yeah.
How many years are we on?
I'm in my 29th year.
How does that feel?
Raise. I know. When I say it out loud, it just sounds like, God, that's such a... It just makes you feel old. But you know, I guess there's worse jobs. And I'm sure we've both had jobs that are worse than what we do now. And yeah, it's kind of crazy that I've done this longer than I've done anything, you know.
Is there an extent to which you started with... I mean, obviously, like, presumably when you started 29 years ago, there were far fewer comics.
No, well...
Or was it still
I started in the 80s comedy boom.
Okay.
Where there were maybe even more comics than there are now. But it's hard to tell how many... I don't know how many comics there were then or now. But, yeah, I mean, I started in Florida where you could... There was comedy everywhere. Every city in Florida had... Not every city, but... All over Florida.
Because I don't think we had a boom over here.
No.
Like the 80s that we did, but there were like 12 people involved.
I think you had your 80s boom like 10 years after we, you know, in the 90s maybe. I don't
sure.
know when. But, so there was comedy everywhere when I started.
And were you inspired by that kind of stuff to start? What drove you to start in the first place?
I was out of college when I started. I never, ever wanted to do stand-up. Never even thought about it for more than a second, I don't think. And then I just went to open mic nights, and then I just sort of got this. I would go to the, you know, they would have these, it was definitely, I don't know how the open mics here are, but in New York, a lot of the open mics are, you go there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they make you buy a drink, and you perform for the other, the other comics, and maybe some stray regular in there, maybe. So they're not the most realistic, you're not really doing a show necessarily. It's definitely worth doing, but when I started, they had the open mics in during a regular headliner show. Like a headliner would be there Tuesday through Sunday or something, and on Tuesday they would have open mic, then an opening act, and then the headliner.
Okay.
So you played to a real, and this was in the 80s when everyone, people were just going to see comedy just to see comedy.
Sure.
So you'd have this, you know, 100 people, 200 people on a Tuesday, and they're a real audience, and you do your 5 minutes. And you could just, at least down there, and you could just sign up by going, you know, I want to try this. And they go, how about next Sunday? And then all of a sudden, you're a comedian. Or, you know what I mean?
All of a sudden, I mean, that does sound markedly.
I mean, they're pretending you're, you know, you have a chance to be a comedian.
That does sound markedly different to the environment of comics starting now.
Yeah, I don't. It is definitely a different world. And
would you have survived as a comic if you'd started now, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, because I sort of, I moved to New York after doing it. I moved back to New York after doing it in Florida for only about a year. So, I mean, you know, if I meet someone now who's done comedy a year, I go, you haven't really, you're very new.
Yeah, were you about to say you're not a comic?
No, I mean, I probably was about to say that, but I wouldn't really say that. That's a little harsh, I think. But, yeah, so, I mean, in a sense, I did start. It's not like I arrived in New York and, like, everyone was like, oh, my God, we got Chuck Howard who just moved to town. You know, it's like no one gives a shit. I had some people who, comics who sort of helped me get a foot in the door at some places.
Okay.
But it's not like, you know, they're not like, oh, my God, there's a new comedian in town. We should really.
Who were your allies back then? Who were the people helping you out?
Well, it was like a guy named, it was just a guy who's not, you know, I don't think he's very well known here, but there was a guy named Vic Henley, who was a Southern comic who I happened to work with in Florida, who lived in New York, and he kind of helped me get in at a couple clubs. But then I ended up getting in and out of clubs, and it was never like, I mean, some people move to town and boom, they're off and running.
Okay.
For me, it was just persistence, I think, and sort of not being sort of just going, all right, this sucks. I hung out all day and I didn't get on stage, but I'm going to do it tomorrow.
When you say some people moved to town and boom, they were off and running, what do you think, what quality or what circumstances were they enjoying that enabled that to happen for some people?
Well, I think, I mean, I've always said, I don't know if I actually believe this, but if I had it to do over again, I would have been on the road for maybe 2 more years before I moved to New York.
So that when you arrive,
you arrive and you're just like, oh, a 10-minute set, yeah, that's not a problem. But, I mean, not that I couldn't do a 10-minute set when I moved there, but you always, I mean, I think there is a tendency to think you're better than you are. But there's also just general, you know, just they're not, it's competitive and they just don't, there's not a real, like, there's no reason for them necessarily to be excited about you.
Yeah. That's a hard lesson, I think, for a comic, when you realize that actually no one cares.
Right. I mean, they do care, but they also, they're not, they probably see you more as a pest than a...
yeah. Or certainly seeing, like, I've definitely heard newer comics kind of going, if they won't give me a gig, how am I supposed to get better? And you're like, that doesn't occur to them. Do you know what I mean?
Right. But there's also comics who have a distorted sense of entitlement, and they are, where you talk to them and you go, well, you're not really trying to get on stage, so that they're not going to come to your apartment and ask you if you want to do a show.
Sure.
So you can't just, you can sit around and complain to your friends, but you really should just go out there and bite the bullet and just try.
So you had persistence.
Yeah.
What were the other tools in your arsenal early days?
I think I did have good jokes. I mean, I don't think maybe any of them were ones I'd be proud of now, but I think I showed some sort of, I mean, there were people way back when I did get on, like at Catch Rising Star, which was a huge club. I mean, I remember like Seinfeld was in the back once and he came up to me and complimented me. And this is like 25 years ago. So I must have had some sort of talent, I guess. Ooh. I've never said that before, but no, I must have had some skills that.
Do you remember your most trustworthy joke from the first year or two of your career?
Oh, God. First year or two.
Or like the first one that you thought, oh, that's what I wanted to write. That works.
I mean, I don't know if it was the first year or two, but maybe 4 or 5 years in. I mean, I had a few. I don't know, I feel silly doing jokes in my
Would you mind, just for the sake of analysis, would you mind butchering one for me?
I had one, this is probably 4 or 5 years in, where I'm just going to try to struggle to remember it.
Yeah, that's fine.
Where, just something about how I had sex with a woman and I took out the box of condoms and then she took it from my hand and said, "Oh, good choice." And something to the fact of I didn't expect her to be a virgin, but this was a weird time to show brand loyalty. And it was pretty good. I was like, "Oh, that's a pretty good joke." And I mean, I think I could still do that joke if I wanted to do a 20-year-old joke.
And that's a very you kind of a joke, I think. It's like a reaction. I've just been listening to a few of your albums recently. It's like a person said a thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And it's also like they're quite unusual setups. It's not like a person said a thing that is inherently funny.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? You're really good, I think, at mining unusual angle.
I think someone criticized me for like doing jokes like that. It's like, why? What's wrong with it? I don't.
Oh, what? That it was formulaic, that you were responding to things?
I think
things,
they
use
the term straw dog or something. I don't know. Straw man.
Like inventing a thing that someone said
these
so
were
that you
all,
can comment on it.
I guess so. I forgot what a straw man is, but I
think it's when you collate someone's you reframe someone's argument in such a way that you can defeat it.
Yeah, maybe that is what I do then. But I mean it's all real encounters. So so in a sense, it's I've always thought it's like I'm not a story. Like when someone asks me to do a storytelling show, I go yuck, I don't want to do your storytelling show. But I guess what I do is often just very short stories.
Yeah, I think so. I think another of your great skills is in finding tag after tag after tag after tag.
Yeah, I love when that happens. I did an interview in the States with Terry Gross, who's pretty high profile NPR, and she played a lot of my stuff, which people don't usually do during.
Okay.
And she played this joke, and I was like, wow. It's pretty. I was like, well, that's not a bad joke. It's a long one. I was like, wow, how did I? I was proud of myself.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I can write a nice minute and a half, 2 minute joke.
So talk to me about the writing of a joke where there's loads and loads of tags. Are those tags all coming about in moments of improvised on like repetition?
Yeah, I do very little homework as far as, and I always say that I wish I did. I should do more homework. It's just so not. I don't know if it's laziness or just process, because someone like Louis and a lot of comics don't sit. I mean, like, I think Seinfeld will probably write out a joke. You know, he sits there with a legal pad and writes it out word for word, and that works for him. But I tend to come up with the germ of an idea and just start and just beat it to death, basically.
On stage.
Yeah. And you know, there's always the thing like, I feel like there's another thing I could say about this. And then if I think of one, then it's great to pile on. Because I don't even think I do that enough. Because I hear other comics who are like, like a Bill Burr or someone who's like, man, he could like go buy an ice cream cone and talk about it for 15 minutes or something. But yeah, so I mean, I do love when it's like stacked on.
And as those stacking those ideas on, are you thinking about them during the day when you're on the bus, or is it just that they come to you on stage when you're tunneling into the
I mean
the
I
idea?
Will think about it during the day. I a lot of it is just because I'm just so scattered and so my attention span I think is pretty weak, but I think that's a lot of comics. I see comics, now I haven't seen this in a while, but I'm starting to see comics with their notebooks and like, oh, good, people are back to being comics again. Like,
oh, yeah?
Well, I mean, it seemed like there was a time where it was about like, using comedy as a stepping stone to something
else.
And I kind of miss like, when I was a kid, we used to just talk about jokes and gigs, and you guys are talking about deals and agents.
Auditions and stuff.
Right, yeah. And so I wish I had like a thing where I wake up at 10 a.m. and then I, make a coffee and I don't leave the house for 2 hours until I'm written 8 premises or something. And I'd probably be better off if I did that. But
it's interesting that you
I think most comics feel like that, apart from the very few, but from the Seinfelds who will sit down and go, yeah, okay, here's a show. Or in the UK, there are kind of comics I think of as people who go, yeah, they probably spend 2 months in November writing next year's tour show, and they go, bang, there we go, it's delivered.
Yeah.
And it does interest me that for the rest of us, the majority of us, I think, not only do we not do that, but we also labour under this preconception that we should be doing that. And it seems like a really good way to get a gift of a life and a gift of a career and turn it into something you have to worry about.
Yeah. I guess comics are always, will also often find the downside to things. But I mean, like, I'm writing a book now. I got a deal to write a book. And I've been going into, you know, especially as the deadline approached, I suddenly got like, hey, I'm a guy who goes to the coffee shop and writes for 3 hours every day.
Okay.
And then, and at some point I was like, I'm glad I'm doing this, I guess, but now I kind of wish I had done this with my stand-up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm more prolific than some people and not as prolific as other people is the way I would describe myself. But I, because I was like, man, I remember talking to Colin Quinn about this, and I was like, God, you know, if I just spent a half hour a day writing, and he's like, 15 minutes. I was like, you know what, you're right. And it's like, I don't even, it's always on my mind, I guess, but I don't love sitting around. Like, I think Seinfeld loves tinkering with jokes. Like, he just loves, and I do too, but I just have a different way of doing it.
I think once I started doing that system of, I'm just going to try and sit down for 2 or 3 hours a day, 2 or 3 days a week.
Yeah.
I remember I started doing that maybe 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And it took me like 2 years to stop dreading it. And even now I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to work now. But I make myself do it. And at the end of it, I go, oh yeah, there's some stuff there. But as soon as I discovered doing that, I absolutely had that thing of going, why didn't I do this from day one? What was I doing with my time?
Yeah, I mean, I would have so much more material if I had done that. And I don't know. Some of it is like you can beat yourself up, but some of it's like, well, maybe this is just the way I work and just like I do need to stare into space and walk around and, you know.
I also think there's a shift in, you know, you're saying people are carrying notebooks again.
Yeah.
I think there's been shifts between whether people want to do comedy in order to express themselves, or they want to do comedy. Obviously, the one end of the scale is purely express yourself and be poor and, you know, get the bus home and you did it. And at the other end is get yourself a $1 million movie deal.
Right.
But I also think there's an extent to which, certainly in the UK, I feel like I was at the tail end of a group of people who started doing comedy because it was an alternative lifestyle, because it was an escape from work, from the real world. And then I feel like shortly after I started comedy, maybe 11 years, maybe even 12 years now, shortly after that was the sort of the first outliers of people going, I'm going to have a career at this. Like, all that more of a wave of that happening. I'm sure careerists are on the way.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a career. It's just some people. It depends on how much that infiltrates your comedy, I think.
And do you think, I mean, presumably you're saying that because you believe in a kind of a purity?
I do, but I mean, it's not that I don't. Hey, man, I have an agent, I have managers, I have, you know, I like to get, booked in some place if they're paying me nice money. Yeah, I certainly like that, but I think there's people who are just, everything is filtered through, I'm going to have a career, as opposed to, I like comedy. And a guy described it, a guy I know described, some people I think are more into a scene than they are into comedy.
Yeah.
So I think there are people like, you know, it is a scene. It's your social life. You know, you're probably alone all day, and then at night you see your friends and you tell your jokes, and then you're alone again the next day. And but I mean, maybe not everyone's as alone as I sometimes am. But
so, of the group of people that you started out with, who then went on to make it, like you mentioned, Louis and some of the other people, I'm sure that we would know in the UK.
Yeah.
I noticed, I was looking at some of your TV credits, and I feel like I've kind of mentally got you in this category of, oh, he's one of those people that plays a fictionalized version of himself.
It seems that way, yeah.
On TV shows
created
by his buddies from back in the day. Is that fair? I don't mean to detract from the work.
There was a time, you know, I was filming Louis and this show Delocated, and I was like, I'm playing myself in two consecutive jobs. or concurrent jobs, I guess is the word.
How did that feel? Like realizing...
I mean, it's a type of thing where, you know, both those shows were fun and interesting and funny, but, you know, if you had to... I mean, it's not my ideal thing to play myself, but on Louis it works because it is about... There's some sort of realist... There's some sort of documentary, slightly documentary feel to that, in that the comics you sit around at the real Comedy Cellar with, you know, their real names. Of course, you know, the situations are heightened and fictionalized, but...
And whose fictionalized version of yourself are you playing? Are you playing Louis' version of yourself, or are you playing your version
of
yourself?
Yeah, I mean, like...
Without getting too Inception about it.
I mean... Yeah, because, I mean, I did a scene on Louis. It was a pretty big scene he gave me, which was very nice, where I went through a day in my life. And did you see that one?
I didn't see that one.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty long. He gave me a good – it's a good 6-7 minute probably scene. I don't know. Maybe longer, maybe shorter, but it's big. And but he wrote it for me. So there were times where I was like – like there was a time where – one scene where he kept having me go boom – like I said, and I go, boom. And at some point he goes, you don't like saying, you don't want to say boom, do you?
Yeah.
I go, I'd rather not say boom, like every third sentence. And he's like, don't say boom. And, you know, there was a scene where, like, I got a, I don't know if that ended up in the final cut, but I was getting ramen at a place and they had a punch card and your 10th one was free. And like, and I go, and I threw a dollar in as a tip. It's like, if I got a free one, I'm not going to just tip a dollar.
Yeah.
And I was like, can we make it like some ridiculous, can we make like $8 or $7? So there's stuff like that where I kind of, where you kind of worry. I mean, part of it is just like, it's a TV show. I'm along for the ride. I'm going to take one of the team. But there are times where you're like, well, I'm kind of thinking people might think this is the way I really am.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of idiots that watch TV, right? Yeah. And for someone who doesn't talk about their private life really in their act, their personal life,
right?
To actually kind of go, oh, this might be one of the most publicly viewed versions of what I'm like. Like, you know, in 100 years, people might still watch that and go, no, that was Todd Barry. He used to say boom all the time.
Yeah.
So, and, I mean, is that...
That's kind of it, yeah. I mean, not that... I mean, ultimately, if the people thought I said boom a lot, I don't think people would be thinking about that forever. You know, it's just like they move on to something else. But at the time, I think, you know, he picked up on it and was like, yeah.
So this is Todd. Thanks, Todd, for coming on the show. It was a great pleasure to have you. We will get right back to Todd in just a second. I've just got a couple of little notices. First, Hari Kondabolu, who you'll remember from a previous episode earlier this year, brilliant comic, is released. He's just released his album, Mainstream American Comic, which is available at www.killrockstars.com/Hari, H-A-R-I. If you haven't caught up with that episode yet, please do. He's an absolutely superb comic, very, very funny writer, very political act, and that album. I'd be lying if I said I'd listened to it yet, but I can honestly tell you I am going to listen to it on the plane to Montreal, which I'm going to be on in a couple of days. I recommend that. I saw a tiny clip from it, so I can recommend it honestly. But, I mean, his last album was so great. I cannot wait to hear that. So check Hari out at killrockstars.com/Hari. I also just briefly are going to advertise a friend of mine, Michael Clapham, who was very helpful in hooking me up with Todd. He runs Perfect Strangers Comedy, which you can find out about at perfectstrangerscomedy.co.uk. And he brings American comics over to the UK. People like David Cross, Bill Burr, Todd, Kyle Kinane, Neil Hamburger. And he's got shows coming up with other people like Brendan Burns, Jim Jefferies, Jen Kirkman, the Found Footage Festival. And also keep your eye out, he says, mysteriously, for a huge American comedy show coming to the UK in October. And I know what that is, and it's pretty exciting, but it's top secret for now. He also runs or co-runs Group Therapy in Manchester, which is a brilliant comedy club, and is, I think, expanding into Nottingham and Leeds this autumn. So check out Group Therapy and check out perfectstrangerscomedy.co.uk to find out more about what Michael's up to. Very good guy when it comes to touring and organising shows with American comics. So, very nearly there. Thanks as ever for your donations. how can I say this in a way in which I've not already bored you to death with before? I'm going to give myself 20 seconds just to remind you that your donations are the lifeblood of this show, as it takes up more and more of my time in research and admin and organization. It's really important to me that you keep supporting the show. So thanks to everyone that's made a recurring payment, which you can do of £1, £2, £5, or even £10 at comedianscomedian.com/donate. If you're feeling extra flush, you could chuck in a one-off donation. I think what I feared might happen has happened. I mentioned that I got £100 donation in an attempt to get someone to better it, which they duly did the following week, and since then they've completely dropped off. I think everyone's gone like, whoa, everyone's dropping £100 on Stew, are they? I think I'll step back. Those were rare, nay, freak occurrences. So if you would like to shore up the recent dearth of donations, you can do that now. Maybe it's as good a time as any. Maybe now is the right time for you to go, hey, I bloody love ComCom me. Maybe I'll support Stew as he heads up to Edinburgh. And let's face it, you are the guys who get to know about all the exciting secret stuff. I've put this information on the ComCom Facebook group. But also, if you're listening now, then you and you alone shall know that 6:45 p.m. every Tuesday during the Fringe, I'm doing ComCom Redacted, which is a crazy little secret, sort of arguably quite vicious in places format show. It's not being recorded. It will never be recorded or reproduced anywhere. But we're going to do some little sort of, it's a little fun, friendly ComCom cockabout. So maybe I've kept it so exclusive there'll only be two of you in the audience. Why don't you be one of those two? And those are 6:45 every Tuesday at the Banshee Labyrinth Chamber Rooms, which you can find, I think it's just off Nidri Street. The main show, of course, is Compared to What. I have my final preview tonight. It is so ready. I'm going to have to cut 12 minutes from the show. So it'll probably be extra stuff about the baby. And I don't know. I've got a really good bit about feather headdresses, which I really like, but I don't know if it sits in this show. Let's see what decisions I make. You can come and see that show at 3:45 p.m. daily throughout the Fringe. It was so great last year to have so many of you come and support the show and come and take a chance on seeing me live, those of you that hadn't already. And I'm pleased to report that every single person who came up afterwards and said they were a pod fan really enjoyed the show, or at least had the decency to lie to my face. So if you're thinking of trying it out, please come along at the Liquid Rooms Annex daily at 3:45 p.m. from the first Saturday of the Fringe until the end. It's not on the middle Monday, but it is on every other day. And there's some really good gear. The Airbnb bit is bloody great now. That is rocking nicely. And the heaven stuff's great. The porridge stuff is great. The fox, the chicken, the bag of grain is now working. Now I've stopped trying to be so clever. And there's some other great new stuff about motorcyclists. And who knows, maybe even for the headdresses. The nitrous oxide bit is just mwah. So, the last final preview tonight. I don't know, am I convincing you or myself? I'm feeling good about the show. So, that's everything I need to mention. Donate, support the show, share it on iTunes, rate it on iTunes, share it with people that you know and love and love and know. And let's get back to Mr. Todd Barrett.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Let's talk about your authority on stage.
Okay. And
particularly in terms of the crowd work tour. There's a lovely moment at the gig in San Francisco where you say to someone, are you ready, sir? And that, to me, that kind of echoes the tone of the whole movie and the mm-hmm. whole tour, I guess.
Yeah.
Because there's this contract between you and the audience. They're like, right, I'm gonna go for you now.
Yeah, there is. But there's also, here in London, there's been a couple of times where I've just said, all right, I'm done talking to
you. Yeah.
Not because I'm being a jerk. Or I don't think anyone should have to come to my show feeling like they're with any more desire than just to watch the show. So if someone doesn't want to talk, I wouldn't want to talk either. So I don't want to like browbeat someone. Be like, I don't want to be a bully on stage.
I don't think there's any danger of that. Have you ever crossed a line where you've kind of thought I went a bit too hard there?
Maybe no. Yeah, I mean, there's been times where I've probably said things that I regret. Yeah, just you know.
What kinds of things?
Could you be more specific? I remember making fun of someone because like he and his girlfriend both worked at Burger King, and it just kind of struck me as funny that they both worked there. And then I kind of just saw this look in his eyes like, oh man, why am I making fun of him? You know, I was, my heart wasn't really like ugly when I was saying it, but I did feel like, oh man, this guy's not really enjoying this. I felt like I just didn't want to be like an elitist, like, well, I think that's a hard job. I worked at McDonald's, so I know what it's like.
And yeah.
But I sort of felt like a little bit of a shit then. But I mean, I've certainly seen comics do worse than that.
Yeah, right. Were you able to kind of row back from that moment on stage?
It was a long time ago, so I don't remember. But I imagine I softened it or something, did something to.
So when you're just to stay on the idea of authority.
Uh huh.
A lot of it is, it seems to me, a lot of the most successful, or for me, the most satisfying improvisations with the crowd are when you are almost shining a light on a lie that people are telling themselves or telling the rest of the room. I mean, maybe a lie is too strong a word, but, you know, with the band, for example,
yeah,
you really seem to delight in kind of guessing information about people based on how they're presenting themselves.
Yeah, I do. And I mean, that scene with the band seems it's the most talked about scene in the film that, yeah, I mean, that was an example of me basically insulting people. But I mean, if you watch their reaction, they're delighted by it. And I've since had them open for me last time. I did a crowd work show in LA. So they live in LA. Why don't I throw them a gig? So I did. And I'm sure they're very nice guys and they appreciated it. But they were, you know, they were good natured. To have a band that's potentially that pretentious laugh at themselves is pretty nice.
Yes. So do you think you're kind of, I don't know quite what I'm asking. There's something about the sharedness of the gig experience. There's like the audience are with you.
Yeah.
There's a listener and a friend of mine called Dave Carden who listens to this show. And he posted a few weeks ago on the podcast Facebook group. He said, I'm really in two minds because I'm going to go and see Todd Barry in Manchester and I've seen the Netflix special and I really want to sit down the front, but I'm really scared. What if he...
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? And he's not a comedy performer.
Right.
So there's a certain amount of like, I don't want to be picked on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he sort of finds it quite delicious. He's like really...
You're curious, yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of willing to offer himself for sacrifice.
It's kind of the reason you might start doing comedy is because you're like, oh, this sounds awful, but I kind of want to see what it feels like.
Yeah. And yet there's this kind of very warm spirit in the room. Someone asked, I was sort of asking for questions from listeners for you.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said that it kind of, someone wanted me to ask you whether you felt like you were, whether you felt it was possible to get laughs from people without mocking them, without putting them down. But I don't know if that's a question I felt was the right question, because it seems
that sounds like they may have thought I was mocking people, but I mean, I am mocking them, but I'm not. I mean,
it's warm though, right?
Yeah, it's never. Yeah, I am mocking them, but I'm mocking them in the way that you could mock me, and I would be fine with it. I mean, I people make fun of me for, you know, other comics for the way my delivery and how I whisper, and then I don't get mad at them. But
so you're let's talk about your delivery. Let's talk about your persona. And
okay,
the Todd Barry. Experience. That's a terrible way of putting it. did you start off, when you first started off as a comic, were you talking did you sound like this?
I don't think so. At some point I realized that there's a different way I talk on stage, and I honestly don't like it when I feel like I go into like, here's the way I deliver my jokes, as opposed to just the way I'm talking to you or the way I would talk to someone during a crowd work thing. So I got into this cadence. I think it probably because I sort of lock in my jokes. I've always wanted to do a loose show, have tight material and a loose show.
Okay.
And yeah, at some point I just sort of locked into this way of speaking, and sometimes I listen to it and I'm like, ugh.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's pretty common aversion that people have to hearing their own voice on recorded, but. Yeah, I think when I first started, I describe it as comic-y, you know? It's like, you know, apparently, no.
Okay.
Like the cadence of what I thought a comic was supposed to be like.
Yes.
Then I think I developed more of my own voice. But when it happened, I have no idea. But.
And it's interesting to hear that you don't like to listen back to it or that you recognize an element in it. Is that because you think it feels false, or do you think it feels still comic-y somehow compared to your...
Well, it's interesting because now, I mean, when I first started, I would drive, like, I lived in, like, outside of Fort Lauderdale, and I would drive to one of the open mics in West Palm Beach, was like an hour, and I would record my set on a cassette. Then I would listen to it on the way home because you're just like, oh, my God, listen to that. I got laughs. And
yeah.
And now, you know, sometimes I'm on TV and I don't even watch it or whatever. Or I'll, most of my TV things I've watched one time, and I don't know. I kind of don't like that. I almost would rather be still, like, bright-eyed about it. But,
yeah.
But, I mean, it's like you hear about people like Woody Allen. You know, they finish a movie, and they don't go watch their movie. You know, or Dylan doesn't listen to his albums or anything. But I don't know.
But presumably your cadence and your voice, these are big parts of why you are the success that you are.
I imagine. I mean, yeah. I mean, I've done something right.
What do you think you've done right?
Oh, shit.
Yeah. You have clearly done a lot of things right.
I mean, I at my best, I do know, I feel like, oh, man, I'm pretty good at this. And
what are your terms for being pretty good at something?
I think being, I sort of like, it's weird, because I like some comics who just really go by the book and deliver the, have you ever seen Brian Regan?
Yes.
He's great.
Yes.
But he's not a guy who's going to fly off the handle during a show. Not that I fly off the handle, but he kind of just goes out there. He's got these great jokes and this great delivery, and he does it, and you're fucking cold in your stomach and you can't breathe watching him. And then there's someone like Dave Attell who, like, you almost want to – sometimes it's more fun to watch him with a shitty crowd.
Yeah, sure.
Because he'll just make these snide remarks, and they're hilarious. And just so he's sort of a loose cannon with great jokes. I forgot what my original point was. Or your question.
I was asking about recognizing the benefit. Oh, yeah. What is it that you...
Yeah, so I think when I tell a good joke and then I say something spontaneous, I mean, the best comics are the ones where you feel like, oh, that's an actual funny to the bone person. You know, it's even like Don Rickles, who's like 90 and you're now or whatever. And you're like, oh, this dude's, he's just a funny, he lives and breathes funny. And, you know, not that some comics aren't boring off stage, like I might be right now. But,
do you feel that you're a funny person, or do you feel that you're a person saying funny things?
Oh, I think I'm a funny person, yeah. I will give myself that credit.
Are you ever going to write another joke again, now that you've proved
that crowd
work?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm in the middle of doing... I'm actually, except for this little vacation, not a vacation, but a vacation from that, Yeah, that's what I've been working on, and at home I've been, you know, I record all my sets, and then I have to really force myself. I don't have like a, I know people like they record the set, then they go home next morning, they listen to it, and it's like, I have, you know, 100 of them stacked up.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the rule rather than.
And then you're like, and as you stack them up, you're just like, oh, I don't want to listen to 80 of the bests or 80 of the same set. But you know, sometimes if I am not lazy, I will name. You know, you can name the file on your phone. It takes 2 seconds, and you can just, like, listen to the pizza joke or something. And then,
yeah, I sometimes I label them with things like, listen to this, you bastard, because I know that I'm not going to want to.
Exclamation points, yeah. I do the same thing. But then and then when I actually do listen, you know, especially because you can, at least on my phone, you can burn through it, like, at double speed. So you can get past the joke that you think is already done. And then
that's
get to
a great tip. Okay.
Yeah, because it's just like, all right, then you can, you know, you can check your email while you're burning through it and then get to that one point. Because there are definitely times where I've gotten something out, didn't record it, and never, and I'll get that back. And it's
never
gone.
Comes back.
Yeah.
So when you're listening to them, are you making notes? Are you writing stuff down, or are you pacing
around?
I rarely,
because I don't know what to do with the note if I write it down. I sort of make a mental note.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't really have a – there's probably a great system that I could come up with. But I don't know that writing it down – and then I guess I could look at what I wrote down. And I don't know. It's a lot of – it sounds so much work.
What did you want to achieve when you started in comedy? What was your goal as a comic?
I always knew I wanted to be in show business on some level, but I really didn't honestly have a goal. I kind of just did it. I've never been a guy. I just looked at Jimmy Carr's tour schedule and he's booked up. He's got his whole year mapped out. And I'm not booked past, well, I got some stuff in September and maybe October, but I don't have like fill my calendar.
Yeah.
So there's part of me that wants to just sort of leave things open, but I end up working a lot anyway, so.
And, my follow-up question was going to be, do you think you've achieved that? So if you didn't have, like, a vague idea beyond become a comic.
I mean, I've done more than I ever would have thought of doing. But at the same time, you know, then you find yourself, like, in a hotel, and there's something you don't like about the hotel, and you're like, fucking bullshit. And you get angry, and then you're like, oh, I've did all this other stuff. Maybe I should think about that and be glad that someone got me a hotel room.
Are you happy?
Oh, man. I'm sometimes happy. I don't know if I'm like a... I don't know. That's a rough one.
Okay.
What's your next question?
Okay. Do you not want to talk about when
no,
you're happy?
No, not really. No, I don't.
I'm really surprised to hear that you don't sit down and write the bits down, because I think you must have a very well-ordered mind, because some of the turns of phrase that you use are so rich.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the bit about ordering the gimlet and sort of old, very old bit, and the idea of which album is it?
I wouldn't call it that old.
That's 2012,
like
I was confusing the two albums in my head.
4 years old.
So that bit, like the different versions of words that you're putting into the mouths of different bartenders.
Yeah,
one of them is something like, oh, for many years I refereed a transgender Scrabble tournament.
Yeah.
And I made a note of that and I just wrote, refereed! Like that word is it all hinges on the word refereed. That's just, it's like an invention further again.
Yeah. Is that not a word, refereed?
Yeah, of course. Oh, okay. Of course it is. But the idea that, like, rather than just saying, for many years I played in it, or I used to watch
Transgender. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those jokes. I vaguely remember that joke. I remember it on some level. But, yeah, where you just go, all right, I got one version of this. I should come up with a few of these.
Yes.
Because that's always nice when it's like, I can come up with a few of these, and then the joke's longer, and also I get more laughs. So
yeah. But the specific wording of the joke,
right,
I think, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's just something that pops in my head, and then I try it again and again, and then it's like it gets locked in there. But it's all kind of upstairs, you know.
Is there a richness that you're aiming for? Because it seems to me that's a big shift of, like, it's a big paradigm shift to be you're not just involved in a transgender Scrabble tournament, you're refereeing it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, is there something...
I didn't have to hear the joke, but I probably wanted to just change it up from the previous tagline. So.
Okay.
So three different versions where it's not like you refereed this, then you refereed this, then you refereed this. You don't want that word in there in all three of them.
Yeah.
So you sort of find synonyms or things that are similar.
Sure.
But where the joke is not like, it would be a better, it would be a worse joke if I said referee in every single.
No, of course. But I think it's about the picture that you paint. Like your joke about, getting, like, meeting very aggressive prostitutes who assume that you have the money to pay them. And you're like, absolutely, you know, come back to the hostel.
Yeah.
And there's, I think there's a line about, like, you're going to crash into the Danish runaway and cause it to drop his iPhone.
I mean,
do you see what I'm getting at? It's such specific, the fact that the runaway is Danish. It's vivid.
Like, yeah, I like that. No, I like that you notice that. And that, yeah, I do, when I'm hearing that, I'm, like, smiling. I like to really just leave no stone unturned, kind of.
Okay.
That's a hacky cliche. But.
Well, I'm trying to apply this. I'm writing a show at the moment, take up to the Edinburgh Festival, and I'm trying to apply a kind of a Todd Barry-ness to some of the writing, because I feel like, oh, that I'm actually not being specific enough about that idea. I'm being a bit general.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing where I kind of. Like, even when I'm writing this book, I'm look at these sentences, and you're like, that's just so boring. And I'm going to have to, you know, take a break and go back over and go, well, you know, I got to make this interesting. And just sort of just, yeah, just how can every word pop or just be essential? And
what's the book? What's the book that you're writing?
Book's kind of a tour diary kind of situation.
Okay.
But.
Can you tell us any more than that? Are you being secretive about it, or is
well,
it
it's
just
about.
It's not
I guess I can just. It just doesn't sound very good when I describe it. It just, basically, I booked a bunch of what I guess they would call secondary markets, so not like Chicago, L.A., and I played those places well, but I just booked a bunch of these, just like Lansing, Michigan, and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and also like Tel Aviv and Maui and. Places where not necessarily every comic goes to.
Sure.
And so it's a tour diary based on that.
Okay.
But
and is it where does the impetus come for projects like that and like the crowd work tour? Just to, like you said at the very beginning of when we were talking about wanting to shake yourself up.
Yeah, I mean, I've always done, and I wish I did more things because it's like I love doing stand-up, but it just sometimes it's just like you just want to change and you want to do something different. So the crowd work tour was just almost a joke to myself. I was like, what can I do next? I'm going to do a crowd work tour. And I was like, oh, why don't I? And that at that time, I didn't have it. I was between agents. So I just emailed people I knew and put together a little tour myself pretty easily. And and I'm glad I did that. But like the book was just a thing where there was a book guy at my management company, and he wanted to meet me, and we talked, and he kind of, so let's think of an idea, and then
okay.
He got me a book deal. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm writing a book now.
Okay.
So I don't know.
I've got a couple of listener questions for you
before
we wrap up. So Chris Stokes, who I know as well, he's a very good comic.
Uh-huh.
He says, which is more of a challenge, writing material or ensuring your crowd work hits the same beats as written stand-up?
Oh, that's a good question. Which is more challenging? I feel like writing a joke is more challenging because like I said, when I'm doing the crowd work, if someone's just boring me or it's just not into talking, I can just move on until I find something. So in a sense, that might be easier. But it does sound more challenging to do the crowd work. So
it does. I do wonder if whether sometimes with crowd work, audiences get more behind it. It feels more magical because they know it's improvised.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you notice that if you say something, if I say something during a set and then I, you know, if I'm doing my jokes and they're doing fine and then I interact with someone and I come up with something.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my, yeah, magical is the right word.
Yeah.
It's,
and I wonder
people are like, oh, that's for us.
Yes.
That just happened for us.
Yes. And I wonder sometimes whether, and I don't mean this specifically about you and your crowd work at all, but I think generally I wonder as a comic whether it can feel to the performer like it's a bit of a scam.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like I've got the ability here,
mm-hmm.
and I know you'll be way more impressed if you haven't seen many improvised shows. Do you see what I mean? I was talking about this with, there's a company called The Noise Next Door who do like a 5-person improv, get someone out of the audience, you know, taking suggestions, stuff like that. And I was just kind of putting it to them in a friendly way that audiences sometimes can be bowled over by the appearance of magic.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, Yeah, I mean, I ran into a guy yesterday at the Soho Theater I was standing by the box office. He goes, "I just saw your show. I'm buying a ticket for Saturday also." And my kind of media reaction was like, you know, oh, that's nice, but also, oh, you don't want to see it twice. But I think a crowd work show you could watch twice more than. I mean, I have people, not a lot, but there's people you like three tour dates in a row. They show up to see me, and you're like, "Come on, man, you're killing this."
Why would they be killing it?
Not because I just feel like I've gone to concerts where like a band comes to town. When I'm young, it's more of a thing I would do when I'm younger. Like, and they're playing two nights. I'm going both nights. Mm-hmm. And the second night, it's just never.
Yeah, right.
it's like the second cup of coffee. It just doesn't really do it as much as the first one. So, but I think with the crowd work, I don't know that people would watch it a few times and go, "Oh, there's a scam." I mean, they might see familiar patterns familiar roads I go down. But
okay, what sort of what can you give us an example of a road that you go down?
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier, where like if it was a band and
oh sure, I see, yeah,
yeah, and I'll go, you know, I will sometimes go, let's hear some song titles, because I find that that's always a
sure. But presumably if the questions are provocative enough. Yeah. You only need one jumping off point,
right.
And then you're going to get something completely different.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like it's very rare where I'm like, "Oh my God, I've had this exact conversation last night." But
if you were, and we will wrap up with this, if you were to review yourself,
mm-hmm.
Do you read your reviews?
Yeah, I've read the reviews for this show. Yeah.
Okay. And are you satisfied mentally that you can read the reviews and cope with reviews? I mean, I'm sure the reviews are positive.
The ones that I've gotten here are they're all good reviews. But you know, I always find the negative. I've had glowing reviews of myself, and I'd find, "Well, what do you mean with that sentence, man?"
Really?
Yeah. Because sometimes when they're just wrong, when someone's just wrong, or sometimes, like, I was telling someone about this the other day, where I did a show in Canada, and the guys I know is a fan of mine, and glowing review, but at some point during the show, I sort of pointed out a lull that I didn't need to point out. I regretted pointing it out. But then, of course, you know, there was a lull when I read the review. There was a lull, and it's like, you're saying that because I pointed it out.
You
didn't notice that lull as a lull.
Isn't that weird, that kind of antagonism between comics and critics, whereby people want to kind of find a chink in your armor?
Yeah, and also, I mean, I think critics, unless, especially with what I'm doing, I'm finding there's a little bit of, like, it can only be, well, it is kind of just a guy asking, "What do you do for a living?" And I think there's, you know, like there's not a richness to it or a theme, but it isn't. There isn't one. So, you know, and one reviewer who's been very nice to me said, you know, "There's no build." And it's like, well, I don't know. How do I build? You know, unless I know that guy in the corner's got some good shit.
Like, I'm going to try to build, but him at minute 40.
But no, it doesn't build, and it's over in an hour. So it's like, I don't, you know, it's not going to be like, "And here comes the grand finale." But I mean, as far as critics, when I went to Edinburgh, it makes me sweat here. It made me almost not want to come here.
Okay.
Because, you know, if I do a show in New York, that's very unlikely. It's not here, like, you know. Hey, this guy wants tickets. This guy wants tickets. Like, it's a 140 seat thing, and mm-hmm. by the time the review comes out, I'm gonna have three shows left.
Yep.
And a lot of the tickets are sold already. So, but I mean, when I first went to Edinburgh, I really sweated that. I mean, I would. Just,
where did you play in Edinburgh?
I did the Assembly Rooms, but they had me in an 11:50 p.m. slot.
Okay.
And I was like, in the next 10 feet away was the Best of the Fest.
Okay.
So, yeah. Which are you going to go see? You know what I mean? And it was rough. And, you know, and I got some okay reviews, but then there's some, you know, guy. It's one of those things where you get a review, it's 2 stars, and you're like, well, you saw a bad show, and also, you write for the paper that they shove in your face when I take the subway in New York. So who cares? And especially in Edinburgh, where it's like, at least like here, you know, the London Times guy's smart and knows comedy. Mm-hmm. And Steve Bennett seen 18 million shows. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Bruce, I forgot how to say his last name. You know, they're comedy fans, and they And they like me, so that's kind of a... But, you know, someone like Edinburgh, where it's like, all right, you're 21 and you just started here. You want to go review some shows? Because there's 1,800 of them.
Yeah.
And then they sort of get off, oh, I'm a critic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of American comics struggle with Edinburgh. To be honest, I think a lot of British comics struggle with Edinburgh, but we probably know more what to expect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember running into Des Bishop when I was in Edinburgh, and I was just like, God, he's like, yeah, it's a rough festival. Yeah. Like, he's kind of just like, I aired my complaints, but it's also, I mean, there are legitimate reasons why, you know, you can go over and go, why am I doing this? I could go do a show in Minneapolis for 300 people and stay in a hotel, and here I'm like sharing a shitty flat with someone and losing money. Like, what is, it's sort of like a challenge more than like, I mean, I had some great times in Edinburgh, but.
And why are you doing it? What is that challenge?
I went 7 years between doing Edinburgh's and,
That's about the right rotation. That should be a rule. You're not allowed back within 7 years everyone.
I mean, I think there's a handful of people who could pull off the every year thing, but I don't know. I feel like it creates an atmosphere of sort of... I feel like if you write a show, it should be one that's not disposable after a year. So you start over and like... I think the year is very arbitrary. Like,
yeah.
It's like you don't throw out all your books after a year or everything or something. You know what I mean? It's just... So sometimes I've seen shows there where you're like, oh, that's not a show, but you stay on stage an hour, but that's, you can see where like, you know, I'll do this little fucking visual part. It's going to kill some time. And I've done stuff to kill time also where I'm very aware like, oh, this is going to eat up some time.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm certainly aware of like that, like, all right, I have to do an hour and oh good, this is 6 minutes. That's a nice 10% of an hour. But I don't know what I'm talking about. I forgot what I'm...
We're talking about...
critics.
Why do Edinburgh?
Yeah. I mean, I think I after 7 years, it's just kind of like, all right, I'm gonna get you this time.
Yeah, right.
And also, I went back and I did it with The Stand, and it was like a 3 o'clock in the afternoon show, mm-hmm. which is probably, you know, on the other extreme of maybe a little too early. But I knew they wouldn't be drunks, and there were bigger crowds, and they treated me really well.
I think there's something about how difficult Edinburgh is at a festival. It's like funny saying Des saying it's a rough festival. I think that inspires in comedians, some comedians, a desire to best it, to learn how to do it,
right?
To
yeah.
learn how to game the system.
Yeah, exactly.
So people are doing show. I'm doing my show at 11 a.m. Do you know what I mean? I'm not, but people say things like that. You know, that's like I think Tony Law. This year is doing 11 a.m. shows.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you obviously, if you go back a lot, then you gain a reputation, and someone like Tony Law can do that, and Kitson could, you know, say, I don't want to do shows on weekends, mm-hmm. and my show's at, you know, 6 in the morning or whatever, and it's going to be full, and he's going to be, you know, he's going to do it the way he wants to do it,
yeah.
and make money.
So... If you were to review yourself, bring it back to the critics thing. If you were to review yourself honestly, knowing what you know about your set, if you were to watch, not the crowd work tour so much, but one of your stand-up specials,
mm-hmm.
what would you say are this person's strengths and weaknesses?
Oh, okay. I was just going to say 4 stars.
Yeah.
But
that's very modest.
I don't know. It's hard to know. I mean, it's hard to be your own critic, but I don't.
This is supposed to be a challenging question.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Well, my strengths are, fairly intelligent, unpretentious jokes and witty banter. I don't know. I'm clearly not comfortable with that question, but I could try harder if you want.
I think it's a really interesting question to hear an answer to. What would you say were your weaknesses?
I don't know, because my weaknesses. I know some people probably don't like the quiet delivery, but I don't know if that's a weakness because it probably helped me as much as it's hurt me. I've always said the quiet delivery has hurt me more off stage than it has on stage.
How do you mean?
It's just a perception where like there's, you can't do this. Like we can't put you on this show because you're low key. It's like, well, it doesn't matter that I'm low key.
Okay.
Okay, that's interesting. From the outside, it would just seem like, oh, that's a great angle. No one's doing that.
Yeah, but, well, that is a better, that's more realistic than, yeah, because I've had, you know, I've done shows in like the biggest guy, tough guy in the room, because he goes, hey, that was really laid back. I appreciate that. It's like,
yeah, right.
Right, the guy you would think would want someone jumping up and down and screaming. But, yeah, I mean, I think if I you know, if I had it, if I could become a high energy comic, I would. I think there's an advantage to it. But
really?
Yeah.
That always surprises me. I've heard other people say that. And similarly, high energy comics think, oh, I wish I could expend less energy on stage.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to be like some people go up there and yell. And I just kind of, I never understood, like, why are you yelling? Like, it doesn't seem natural to yell. But I don't yell off stage either. So, but, you know, I am, I'm quiet, so that might not be for everyone, but it wants to be for everyone, really.
I think you have an ability to manufacture flow. I don't mean to contrive, but yeah, to create the kind of flow that in order for me to get, like for me to improvise well with an audience, I need to, they need to be laughing at me, and I need to feel like I'm sailing, mm-hmm, and I need to have a load of energy. And I think you are, in order for me to kind of make those creative leaps that I couldn't sit and write in a room.
Right.
And I think you're able to kind of to let that wind fill your sail without there needing to be loads of energy.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, yeah. Like, yeah, I hope so. Or else I'm in trouble.
Very last question, then. You can interpret this however you like.
Okay.
What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
Oh, my God. Probably just the years I was alive. I think that's not the place for one last witty quote. For me, I would, but I also don't like to think about dying.
Thanks, Todd.
Sorry about that.
Thanks, man. So that was Todd. Thank you to Todd. Thanks again to Michael Clapham for helping hook me up with Todd. And also thank you to Johnny Mounter for his sterling editing work. Thank you to Livy Phipps for a brilliant log for this episode. And thank you to you for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. I appreciate it. Come along 3:45 p.m. daily throughout the Fringe and see my own stand-up show Compared to What. I'm feeling very excited about it indeed. So come up and see that if you're at the Fringe. I will be doing regular Fringe recommendations. I will try to keep the podcast schedule regular during the festival. But, you know, it's an insane month. I'm going to have the Boutros with me. And it's going to be fairly kind of extraordinary, even by my 22-year Fringe veteran standards. So I will do my best, but I will certainly be putting at least one Fringe show recommendation per day on the Facebook group. So if you haven't yet joined the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, I think they cut it off at 5,000, and we are well over halfway there. I think we're on something like 3,700 right now, and it's a really active, engaged kind of community. So please jump on there, and you can get all the recommendations, and that'll do for now, I think. I'm not gonna stick a waffle on you, I'm afraid. Normally I'd chat to you for 10 minutes about what's going on in my life, but what's going on in my life is I am too busy to talk. We're nearly there. Just for Laughs is going to be amazing. Can't wait for Montreal. The podcasts I've arranged are with Lewis Black. That's the big live one. That's going to be so much fun. If you don't know Lewis, get stuck into his work. He's got hundreds of albums on Spotify or wherever else you might find them. And I'm also going to grab Mark Forward, who I saw have a really invigorating gig at Edinburgh last year. Cameron Esposito is on my hit list as well. And I'm looking for one or two other people, but the volume of research required is pretty huge, and the festival starts quite soon. So I will contact you all from Montreal. I'll record a little something there for you. And then I'm back, and it's straight up to Edinburgh. So no time for love, Dr. Jones. I'll speak to you from the festival, from the festivals, and I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase.